Grade 1 Conference, Lecture 45, Storytelling, Part 8. The eminent psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim was an individual who exemplified the rationalistic and scientific mindset of his day. And also worked with the sort of attempt to bring science into the study of the irrational as a Freudian therapist. He was also an individual who suffered under the Holocaust and was himself incarcerated in a concentration camp, survived, and went on to become very highly regarded a writer about that subject and many others. And how interesting that this individual who spanned, we might say, the Enlightenment side of modern life and modern education, but also in a certain way through his Freudian interests also connected himself with the romantic stream. He then, in one of his last books, one of his great books, The Uses of Enchantment, wrote about the central importance of fairy tales. And very interestingly, he spoke about how in the concentration camp and meeting with and interviewing people who had survived that experience and many other horrendous 20th century experiences, as well as individuals who just underwent terrible traumas, especially in their childhood or slightly thereafter. He said again and again, it was so meaningful to him that individuals who could go through a traumatic experience and go forward in their lives and remain, relatively speaking, psychologically very healthy, well-integrated human beings in spite of having gone through hellish experiences, very often these were individuals who had been told fairy tales when they were younger and who, at the time of their greatest distress and despair, imagined themselves to be in a fairy tale, you know, maybe saw themselves as a particular fairy tale figure, or at least were able to embody the difficulties, the suffering, the hardship they were going through as figures in a fairy tale. To put it another way, going back to the philosophy of freedom, these were individuals who were able to create representations, mental pictures. We could take it a little bit further than the philosophy of freedom, to use another term of Steiner's. They could develop imaginations of what they were going through that would, in a way, embody and give a form and a habitation to that suffering. And in some way or other, which, in a way mystified Bettelheim himself, this allowed them to be strong and later on in life, healthy, productive individuals. So once again, if you're having controversies about the fairy tales, you know, don't just kind of make it you against them versus the parents, but draw on others who've had positive things to say about them. And Bettelheim's book does not fail to impress because of his very lofty credentials, because of his own personal experiences, and because of the eloquence with which this, you know, great therapist at the end of his life pointed to a very unlikely source of strength for humanity, that these stories should not be ignored, but really held on to in our time. So that's one aspect, of this kind of archetypal quality, that it's not only nice pictures to have, or it gives the children literary experiences, but that actually these are strength-giving pictures the beings, the creations who embody fairy tales, speak to something that lives within that part of our nature that helps to give us strength and resilience, that sustains our life and allows us to face life and meet life and be part of life and assert life. And this, again, in Steiner's terminology, is the etheric body. Now, I mentioned the imagination, and I said, you know, that these were individuals who were able to imagine themselves removed from the immediate circumstances and seeing themselves as characters in a very, very powerful story. And, of course, we know that one of the hallmarks of Waldorf education in the primary grades, but really throughout, is to help develop the child's capacity of imagination in a time that works so strongly against that. Now, let me give you an example. This has happened more than once when I've given public lectures about fairy tales. So here, you know, people are just coming in off the street who know nothing or at least very little about Waldorf education, or may know that we just are, you know, doing nothing but fairy tales all the time. So I talk about them, and I will get a question very much like this one. Not really a question, more of a comment. Well, look, you know, it all sounds great, and, you know, it sounds really wonderful. The children get these wonderful fairy tales, and everything's great, makes them happy, and life is good. She said, but let me tell you something. You know, like Snow White, and she's, you know, she's dead, and everybody's crying about her, and no one can do anything. And then this prince shows up on his white horse, and, you know, gets off the horse, kisses her, and she pops back into life. And everything's just fine, right? Okay, yeah, well, I know that story. I got that story when I was little myself. And you know what? I've been waiting for that damn prince on a white horse to show up, and he hasn't arrived yet, okay? I don't know if I want my daughter growing up with that kind of picture, okay? All right, so direct quotes, pretty much. So, wow, you're going to get something like this, believe me, you know, probably without the okays, but especially if you're not in New York. So what do you say? You know, or not only what do you say, is she right? Is there something true about this? You know, are we giving the children illusions and pretty pictures instead of preparing them for what life is really like? Now, I don't know that I ever have answered it in a deeply philosophical way, but what I am able to say is something like this. Well, you've made a very good point, and thank you very much for bringing this. If I just can point something out, you spoke about Snow White lying dead in the coffin, and the prince comes on a white horse, kisses her, and suddenly she springs back to life. And, you know, you and perhaps others in this room have been waiting in your life for some time for that prince on a white horse to occur. Well, I can tell you this, that actually in the Grimm's fairy tale that the children hear in the Waldorf school, which is the original authentic tale of the Grimm's brothers, Snow White would also be waiting a long, long time for that prince on a white horse, because there is no white horse. The prince comes on foot. And no, he does not kiss her and awaken her to life. Actually, he cries, he weeps, seeing this beautiful young person in a glass coffin, and he says to the dwarves, bring her back, bring her to my castle. I will give her a place of honor there, and I will just, you know, mourn her in my castle. So the dwarves follow his command. They pick up the coffin. One of them trips, and the coffin falls, at least part of it, bumps against the ground, and that bump dislodges the poison slice of apple that Snow White has not fully swallowed. It's dislodged from her throat. She spits it out. Not a kiss, quite different. And with that, the poison is gone and she comes back to life. That's actually the real Grimm's. The Grimm's stories come, many of them, from the peasantry. They're very earthly people. You know, they know about swallowing things that can kill you and somebody maybe, you know, slapping you on the back and a primitive Heimlich maneuver or something like that. That it's very, very earthy. It's not at all the beautiful white horse. Very, very few figures in Grimm's fairy tales are on white horses. Horses were fairly rare, except for the, you know, the nobility who could afford to keep them. And many a prince would move around on foot through his princedom or kingdom. So you see, the story is very different. Maybe you've been waiting for someone to come and administer the Heimlich maneuver like Snow White. I don't know. But anyway, can anybody tell me where that white horse comes from? Where that kiss to awaken someone from death comes from? Anybody? And of course, there's a kind of rolling of the eyes and a groan, not just at my feeble attempt at humor, but everybody just says, Disney, Walt Disney. And here we go. That what is embedded firmly in the consciousness, I would go more specifically and say in the etheric body of most Americans who have lived since the 1930s, and certainly those who've seen the replays again and again and again in movie theaters, it's the Disney version of the fairy tales, which certainly carry elements of the original. They are, in many respects, in terms of animation, you know, remarkable works of art and invention and technology. They have their place in our world, and we've probably all seen them, no matter how much we may disapprove or feel guilty about that. But I will tell you that what these animations have done very powerfully is to embed images in people's consciousness which are almost inescapable. And why? Because they're animations. Because an animation is made up of many frames that are, they're still photographs. I'm sure you've seen animations being created. You could do it yourself nowadays on a computer. It's still frames, one after another, which move at 24, 30 or so frames a minute, so that they appear to have the persistence of vision, continuity of motion. However, that continuity of motion, that persistence of vision, is not the screen's work, that's our work. Our etheric body goes out because it can't bear jaggedness. It's watery, it's phlegmatic in nature, it likes everything to be kind of smooth. The etheric body works very hard, very actively, so that we can see that animation and it means something to us. But that means that the etheric gets imprisoned in those images. They bear a more powerful impress on the etheric body as a memory body than do ordinary memories that we have of other people. This is why many people today have a whole set of preconceptions about fairy tales that are not based on their reading of the Brothers Grimm. In my own experience, reading of the Brothers Grimm stories, hearing those stories being told in a school setting, faded away by the mid-1950s, except in Waldorf schools, of course, of which there were two or three at that time in the United States. So, you know, most people on the earth today, and certainly most people parenting children in a Waldorf school today, lived in a time when the fairy tales were not told, were not heard, but could only be experienced in the Disney version or in many shorter versions, some of which were acted by live actors, many of which were also animated, that could be seen to this day all over TV. I mean, the fairy tales are still out there, but they are often in such garbled and distorted forms that they're anything but the real fairy tales. And I'll just say one other thing about this, that as I mentioned, by the mid-1950s, you had to search out yourself if you were a child or, you know, older or younger child. You had to search for those fairy tales. Your parents probably weren't reading them to you anymore, and you couldn't even find them in a bookstore. So there was a need, a kind of hollow space in the souls, in the etheric body as well, of children who were growing up in the 1950s. And what happened then in the mid and late 1960s as these young people became teenagers or were already in college and university and were buying their own books? What became the great bestsellers of that time, and which still are now in movie form having a powerful effect? No, not Harry Potter. That was later. But it was the Tolkien stories, The Hobbit and The Fellowship of the Ring. And Edmund Wilson, a very great but kind of rationalistic critic of that time, said, "Oh, you know, this is ridiculous that these are so popular. They're just children's stories that have gotten out of hand." Now, I think we know they're much more than that, but I would say, I wonder if those stories, which had been written much earlier, you know, and had their readership, would they have become wild bestsellers, you know, cult things? And to this day, the movies as well are, I think, the biggest grossing movies ever. Would that have happened if these young people had already had the fairy tales when they were seven? I don't think so. And in fact, you will see that what you don't get at a period of life when it's appropriate, fairy tales at age seven, Norse myths at age 10, 7 years later, 14 years later, usually in seven-year rhythms, the longing, the need for those stories will come back. And you may find those stories and experience them in a new way, or you may find some strange, weird version of them, like in comic books or graphic novels or computer games. Look at the content of computer games. Very strong connections to fairy tales and Norse mythology. So this is how important these archetypes are. And we could say they're so important that there are very powerful forces, we could say Ahrimanic in particular, in our time that are doing everything possible to keep these stories away from children. And we could say that sometimes our parents have sort of bought into that themselves and feel, oh no, they scare them. Oh, it's violent, it's this, it's that, you know, always something. And you have to just say sometimes, okay, you know, please, you'd have to see your child in class to see the real effect of this story. You know, don't project your own relationship to these stories, which is probably very tangential, to what they really are. And these are very, very important content for the children to have. And we'll look, as I said, we'd look at in this lecture, but this is a very important aspect of our work with the fairy tales. We'll look at the archetypes that live within them.